Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joseph Epstein. You can call me Joe. I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading and a past president and current board member of the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest tonight, University of California President Janet Napolitano and UC President Emeritus Mark Udoff. Mark Udoff served as the 19th president of the University of California from 2008 to 2013. During which the UC system faced a number of issues related to the nationwide recession. And prior to leading UC, Udoff served as chancellor of the University of Texas system for 6 years and as president of the University of Minnesota for 5 years. He is a recognized expert in the fields of constitutional law, freedom of expression, and education law. He was a co-counsel for the plaintiffs in the 1973 U.S. Supreme Court case, San Antonio versus Rodriguez. This is a landmark school finance lawsuit. And today, he is a professor of law at UC Berkeley. Janet Napolitano is the current University of California president and a faculty member at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, which I am a board member. President Napolitano was appointed to her position in 2013 after 4 years as Secretary of Homeland Security under the Obama presidency, where she headed 22 agencies and directorates. Before her appointment as Secretary, Napolitano served as the Attorney General of Arizona and the Governor of Arizona from 2003 to 2009. Forbes Media ranked her as the world's ninth most powerful woman in 2012, and she was cited by the New York Times to be among the women most likely to become the first female president of the United States. So those are tonight's program participants. And let me just take a brief moment to set the stage for our discussion this evening. Today, the University of California and other institutions of higher education are facing myriad issues, including proposed tuition hikes, sexual assaults on college campuses, and a drop in public funding. Citizens across the entire political and social spectrum have voiced their concerns. Critics on the left worry about commercialization and privatization, an increased number of administrators, declining access to education, and an excessive focus on sports. Those on the right worry about increasing costs, failures to innovate, and entrenched faculty, and the resistance to market pressures. Just last month, President Napolitano and Governor Jerry Brown announced that they were forming a two-person committee to address these concerns. And they intend to review everything, from pension costs to graduation rates and the entire system's spending patterns. I'm looking forward to today's discussion on the future of higher education, and specifically, what is the University of California doing to make sure that its core mission is carried out successfully? So again, a round of applause for tonight's guests, University of California President Janet Napolitano and UC President Emeritus Mark Udoff. I'd like to start off with a question to Mark Udoff, and I encourage both participants to chime in at the appropriate time and comment on a question, even though I might address it initially to one or the other. So, Mark, California is the most diverse state in the country. California's demographics are changing, and we are headed towards becoming a state where a former minority population will be the majority population. In the election of November of 1996, the voters approved Prop 209, the California Civil Rights Initiative, And Prop 209 prohibits state governmental institutions from considering race, gender, or ethnicity in public employment, public contracting, and public education. So how is the changing diversity, particularly under the umbrella of Prop 209, impacting the University of California? Did you foresee a problem if the student body does not look like the diverse demographic of the state? How is the University of California working with this new diversity?
Thank you. I wanted to start by saying I welcome President Napolitano to the East Bay. No holds barred, no expense spared dinner at Chow's. And she's greatly improved my life. I have a sign in my office at the law school that says Napolitano, 4 miles that way. And the other thing is improve my standing with my mom, who's now 95. She always wondered what I did for a living. And one day I told her I have a $20 billion plus budget. And I looked into her eyes and I could tell she thought, no, what crazy people would put Mark in charge of that much money? But then when she heard that Janet Napolitano was my successor, she said, you must have really had an important job if you really get a famous person like that to be your successor. So in her community in South Florida, it's really buoyed the spirits of my few supporters. What I would say about this, I have a number of thoughts. First, I think the university is trying very hard on to recruit a more diverse student body, and I believe that the president can correct me. I believe Hispanics are now the second largest population. We have Asian Americans, I actually think, are the largest. And so we're doing a better job. I don't want to say it's spread evenly across all campuses. So that's point one. And we need to adapt. And, I sometimes get resentful when I saw my budget cut $1 billion. And I was thinking, it's the wrong time. We educated the Caucasian folks, and we still do, and elites. But now that the state has this substantial Hispanic, African-American, so forth population, we owe it to them even more to provide an avenue in the same sort of course that, say, Earl Warren had when he was a poor kid growing up in California. The last point I'd make is I was not happy with Prop 209. I never hid that from anyone. The chancellors and I filed a brief in the United States Supreme Court, and it went something like this. Yes, we're doing better, and we're getting more Hispanic students, only slightly better for African Americans, but the gains aren't what they should be, and in a moderate form, a modest form, an affirmative action could do us a lot of good in terms of making sure that we're preparing all our children for adulthood and for positions in the economy and in politics and all the rest. So that continues to be my view.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And just to give a sense of the amount of public disinvestment in California, if you hold constant for 2014-15 dollars, in 1990-91, the state of California put in roughly $18,000 per student at the University of California. Today, it's $8,000 per student at the University of California. So there has been large-scale disinvestment. California is not unique in this regard. However, California is unique because it has always had larger aspirations for its public universities and where higher education is concerned. And this should not be a reason for continuing along the path we've set, but to really be thinking about who are the next generation of Californians? How do we educate them? What do they need to be prepared to do? What's our role in that? And I'm sure we'll get to tuition during the course of the hour, but, you know, at what point for a public university should the state, on behalf of the public, play a larger part?
I just read these statistics recently, and I suppose it's impossible to even try to make the university mirror exactly the demographic of the state. But 38% of the state is Hispanic. I think 14% is Asian. I was shocked to learn that only 6 or 8%, I believe, is African American. Of course, there's still a significant Caucasian population. Then there's a mixed racial population. So to me, it would seem like almost impossible with this moving target to try to hit that demographic at the university.
Well, I don't think that's what we try to do. It's not going to be. It's not done to the decimal point. But as Mark said, both for last year's entering class and this year's entering class, and the applicant pool, the second largest demographic now are Latino students, and they have exceeded white students for the first time in California history. This is the demographic wave of the future, and I think we'll see that reflected more and more as the university moves along.
Let me address this question to you, please, Janet. As a former governor, you were an ex officio member of the Arizona Board of Regents, who are the overseers of Arizona State University, the University of Arizona, and Northern Arizona University. Now, this is actually a two-part question. Do you think this experience will help you in dealing with the very famous University of California Board of Regents? You've been there.
Well, here's the way I handled the Board of Regents when I was a ex officio member in Arizona. I let the Board of Regents run the university with the advice and leadership of the presidents, and I viewed my job as trying to get as much money out of the legislature as I could. I do think, having been a governor, and all candor, you know, governors have a lot of pressures, and everybody's coming. They want something, and you have expenses for prisons, and you have expenses for Medicaid, and you have expenses for K through 12. Unfortunately, what happens all too often is that higher education becomes a lower priority. It's the easiest thing to cut. And so while being sensitive to the competing demands in a state like California, I do think it's incumbent upon me in my new role to say, look, we have the world's best public university right here. We need to fight to keep it that way.
Well, the second part of the question has to do with something about the first part, because you were a governor as an ex officio member of the Arizona Board of Regents, but as a governor, former governor, your relationship with Jerry Brown of California. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you're going to have a kumbaya kind of relationship with the governor? Or is the gap between, and you can correct me if my figures are wrong, or is the gap between the governor's proposed $120 million holdback of new state aid to UC and your goals to increase state aid to UC likely to end the honeymoon between the two of you?
No, I think we're both experienced public sector leaders. We both understand the pressures we're each under, and we both understand the importance of trying to work through difficult problems together. This is not easy, but I think we've set ourselves on a course to deal squarely with the issues, be it enrollment growth, demographics, the difference between graduate students and undergraduate students, the different maturity levels of our campuses. Some are very young. Some, like Berkeley and UCLA, are much older. And we also understand the importance of research to the economy of California. And quite frankly, without the University of California, this economy wouldn't be what it is. So we understand we've got a big set of issues here, and we have to work together and are in jointly intending to do so to work our way through them over the course of this spring and in the future.
I'm going to add a C part to this question, and then I'd like Mark Udoff to chime in terms of his relationship with the current governor, and if there's any contrast or any wisdom that maybe you can add to this discussion in that regard. Janet, one of your goals is to make student fee increases, should there be some, predictable and as low as possible. Could you comment on that, please?
Right. Well, what happened, I think Mark can talk to this because some of this happened during the recession, was that both tuition and fees were very much in a peak and valley sort of situation, and so you'd kind of trundle along, and then you'd have double-digit increases. I believe one year there was increase in the middle of the school year. And that makes predictability for families and students virtually impossible. And what we've set out to do at the University of California is to say, look, we don't want to have a large fee and tuition increases. We want to cap them at the most 5% over the next 5 years, depending on what the state appropriation level is. But the notion that we can continue ad infinitum with no tuition and no fee increases has real impacts. It has impacts on our ability to continue to enroll more students. It has impacts on the number of courses we can offer and the ability to graduate students in as close to 4 years as we can. And it has, and this is something to keep in the back of our heads, this is, as I mentioned before, it's the best public research university in the world. You don't want to start seeing tremendous diminishment in quality. So you've got this big jigsaw puzzle has to come together. And after 3 years of tuition and fee freezes, it was time to relook at that situation. But maybe you want to talk to that as well.
I want to say something about governors, because I'm quite an expert on that subject. I've had Arnold Schwarzenegger, I've had Jesse the Body Ventura, Rick Perry, George Bush. I'll compare my governors to anybody's in terms of pure interest. I didn't have a Janet Napolitano, unfortunately.
You would have liked it.
Yeah, and he's interesting, and I mostly enjoyed my time. I remember sitting with him at a Regents dinner, and he started out asking me what I thought of Aquinas, then we moved to Maimonides. And then he wanted to talk about Abraham Joshua Heschel. I won't bore you with who he is. But there's not one governor in 10,000 who knows who this man is. And his heart's in the right place, and he's very smart. But he has strong views, and it's, you know, I'm hoping this committee will work out some reasonable compromise. What I want to say about tuition, I don't want to get too much into the specifics, and predictability is important. But I'd say a number of things. It's not particularly expensive compared to most other good universities, public universities around the country. Second, what I want to say is it's not because the cost of education is going up. The cost per credit hour is actually going down. It's, now you say, how could that be? Because class size is larger, primarily. It's not so much that I'm proud of that, but that's true. And why is it going up? Well, it's like the your health insurance. You go to the drugstore one day, you pay $10 on the copay, you go back the next week, they charge you $20. And you say, is the price of the drug doubled? No. But the insurance company doesn't want to pay. Your price is doubled on the copay. And our copayer, the state of California, had a $1 billion cut. And, you know, Janet has all those numbers. And that, to me, is a major problem. The third thing is, it's a particularly difficult cost problem, because increases in cost are not necessarily correlated with increases in output or efficiency. Think of a symphony orchestra. You give the violinist a raise, it doesn't mean you get a better Mozart. It doesn't mean that people will want to pay the ticket prices. It doesn't mean they pay more concerts necessarily. And we have that in three industries: culture, health, and education. And that is a difficulty. And I think we're going to see some efficiencies, and Janet's already sponsored quite a few of them, but it's not an easy problem. It's akin to controlling health care costs and dealing with symphony orchestras without cutting out some violins and some French horns.
We'll probably be weaving in and out of the tuition issue throughout the evening. There's a question from the audience here that really is quite essential to the analysis of the tuition issue. Very simply, what percentage of students are Californians? We do know that out-of-state students are charged a higher tuition.
They are. They right now, system-wide, about 14%, 13 to 14% of our students, undergraduate students, are out-of-state or international students. But at Berkeley and UCLA, our two flagship campuses, it's a higher number. It's closer to double that. So we're concerned about that, and we're concerned about that because this is California's university. Now, one financial aspect, and it is partly financial. I hate talking about students like they're widgets, but in a financial situation, you have to look at it somehow. And one is that the non-resident supplemental tuition, the extra you pay if you're out of state, basically covers another California student to enroll at the University of California. So one of the reasons why the University of California has been able to continue to increase enrollment, even in the face of a major cut in appropriation by the state, was because it was getting this out-of-state enrollment to cover those California students.
I don't have much to add. I think that's exactly right.
To me, it was interesting to learn in preparing for this evening's program how the cost of education breaks down. It's not just tuition, as we all know. So despite higher tuition fees, they are just 20% of the total cost of college education. The other 80% is room, board, books, and supplies. So, Janet Napolitano, as a UC president, will you be able to provide leadership to help control the 80% of the expenses to UC students? Or as a public figure, are you unable to cross that line to be effective in the private arena? In other words, we're talking about owners of apartment houses, stores that sell books and supplies, those other...
No, we're engaged in that. I'm not sure the split is quite that dramatic. But nonetheless, a big part of going... everybody focuses on tuition, but point of fact is that's only part of getting a higher education. You got to eat. You have to have some place to sleep at night, and there are books and supplies, as mentioned. So yes, we are looking at different campuses on housing, different types of housing investments that we can make, and thereby provide cheaper housing to some of our students. We're putting a lot of pressure on dining, food costs, all of the rest, to try to keep the overall cost of attending the university as low as we can make it and still cover the things we need to cover. I mean, we haven't even mentioned student services fees. Those are basically controlled by the students themselves. But this is where we pay for things like sexual assault prevention. This is where we pay for things like mental health and all sorts of other things that universities in this day and age are being asked to cover.
Joe, I would only add a couple of things. I think the figure is more like tuition is $12,000, a total cost or $25,000 or $28,000 or something like that. Which is a lot of money. I want to say a couple of things. When I was president, we were very sensitive to the housing costs and the food costs. But if you lose money on those operations, there's no state subsidy. You know, I mean, that's the problem. But certainly, you can't control the apartment prices nearby and tell the local Safeway what to charge. Even our writ never went that far. The other thing I want to say is don't be fooled by the tuition. You might think of tuition as being like going into a car dealership and paying what is posted on the window of the car. I mean, the average discount, the tuition is roughly $12,000, but it's probably $8,000 is the average net tuition. Families under $80,000 pay no tuition at all. Then there are Pell Grants and all. I'm not saying it's easy, but that is not really the real price. Private universities are even more radically redistributive. I've talked to a fellow who's a dean at a private law school, and I think the real charge is only 40% of the tuition. So if the tuition is $30,000, they give back all but $18,000 of it. So there are real costs, and it's just the way it works. It's not it's an unusual system.
Well, the sticker price is what's talked about. But only about a third of our students pay anything close to the sticker price is the plain fact of it.
One of the facts is that the state of California, as we all know, has decreased the amount of funding for University of California and for colleges, other colleges and universities in the state, other colleges in the state. But the federal government has not decreased its funding. And you mentioned, Mark, you mentioned the Pell Grants. If the federal government were to, at some point, remove educational funding from its budget, what would happen, do you think, to Pell Grants?
Well, I mean, it's sort of hard to speculate a lot, but the Pell Grants are a fundamental building block for allowing low-income students to attend universities and community colleges and so forth all across the country. Now, the problem is the cost of really going up. I mean, the Pell Grants are over $30 billion, I believe. So it would be a problem. The second thing is, and you can check me my data, if I'm not right, I'm, as often the case, almost right, the tax deductions and tax credits are larger than the total magnitude of the Pell Grants. And they're primarily middle class. They go up to $180,000 a year. We're not talking $40,000 or $45,000 or $50,000. So that's another. If that were to change, I think it would devastate the middle class and cause them real problems. Having said that, I think President Obama's trying very hard, but we don't have a real robust higher education policy. Never had one in this country. Should schools that enroll more poor kids have more federal subsidies? Maybe. Should schools that offer certain types of programs? Maybe. Should schools with higher graduation rates normalize for different types of institutions? I mean, these are things that have been on the table a long time, but they just don't seem to happen.
I'd like to take this opportunity to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. My name is Joe Epstein, I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading. I'm a Commonwealth Club board member and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guests, University of California President Janet Napolitano and UC President Emeritus Mark Udoff, and we're discussing the future of higher education tonight. A few more questions from the audience. We're going to kind of get off tuitions just for a moment here, and it has to do with the, I would call it the academy or the faculty at the University of California. See if I can combine these two questions. They're from different people. Are there any formal criteria outlining the responsibilities and teaching performance for professors? Is there compensation based on satisfying these metrics? And how many courses, for example, do the average tenured professors teach at any one time?
There is a something called the APM, the Academic Performance Manual. It spells out in detail expectations for members of our faculty and the governance of members of our faculty. The University of California is, I often get asked about tenure, you know, what happens after a professor gets tenure. We do have post-tenure reviews of our faculty, and they are not taken lightly. In terms of course load, it depends. It depends on what field you're in. If you're STEM, non-STEM, are you running a research lab at the same time as you're teaching? Do you have a mix of graduate students and undergraduate students, only undergraduate students? I think it's fair to say that our faculty teach in the classroom as much or more than their peers at comparable universities around the United States.
I would just add, because I looked at this carefully, one of the things interesting about UC is the tenured and tenure-track professors really teach undergraduates. And frankly, at a lot of prominent public and private universities, that is not true. So they do teach. The other thing, I don't know what to say, you have to build in, you cannot have the same teaching loads at a research university as at a community college. They simply won't have the engineering breakthroughs, they won't do the medical research.
They won't bring in the federal grants.
And $5 billion a year in federal grants, so you need to factor that in. And yes, it's important for the humanities and social sciences as well. So I don't think it's perfect, and it's largely a peer review process, Joe. But I think it's respectable and perhaps could be improved over time.
A couple of
Very quick anecdote. So my wife and I went to the University of California. First of all, my tuition in 1956 was $90. And I forgot whether it was a semester or a year, and most of that went to the Cowell Hospital because every entering student, probably the same today, had to take a physical examination. So $40, $50 of that $90 went towards that. My wife followed me a few years later at Berkeley, and she took a class called Physics 10, which somebody could say is bonehead physics, but when your professor is Dr. Edward Teller, it's totally different. And that, to me, is like the beauty of the University of California system. There aren't many places you can go, particularly public universities, where you can take a class, and she knew nothing about physics, didn't take it in high school, and have Edward Teller as your professor. So I just wanted to get that anecdote in because I think it is a reason that so many of us alumni feel so strongly about the university that we're blessed to have in this state. So I want to ask this question to Janet Napolitano. In his State of the Union speech, President Obama asked Congress to approve funding so that student enrollment at a community college would be free and without tuition. In addition, experiments are in place to increase the number of community colleges that would offer a four-year bachelor's degree. So up to this point, the California Master Plan for Education, which was drafted and implemented in 1960 during the term of Pat Brown, has been the model for higher education nationwide. Do you think free tuition and four-year degrees at the community college levels is in keeping with the spirit of the master plan? And do you think that this could possibly limit undergraduate enrollment to the UC system, which might place a further burden on the university's budget?
Well, I think there are a lot of things contained in that, but here's just to boil it down. Number one, I was delighted that the president put higher education in the State of the Union at the community college level, recognizing that we need to be lifting expectations beyond high school. As we all understand, if you go to a two-year community college, by and large, if you want a four-year degree, you will go to a four-year university. And so there needs to be a greater discussion about, well, what happens after community college. The question then is, well, why don't you just transform community colleges into four-year colleges? Few things to keep in mind. One is that community colleges exist for a whole host of reasons. Not every community college student is there to get ready to go to a four-year college. They do a lot of training programs, tech ed, other things that don't necessarily require a four-year degree. Number two, creating four-year college degrees is a very time-consuming and expensive process. So I think in California, where there are going to be some four-year degrees created at the community colleges, non-duplicative, primarily it's the relationship between the community colleges and CSU, okay. But where California got right 50 years ago is it was very clear about having three segments of higher education: two-year community colleges, then called junior colleges, the CSU system, which is a comprehensive university system focused on bachelor's degree, and then the research university, which is the University of California. Different admission requirements for CSU and UC. That system has worked well. There's been some fuzziness at the lines, but I think we should be thinking about first principles. What's broken about that system? What doesn't work? If there's a change that can happen that would make it better, then we should consider it. If we're simply looking for a way not to pay for higher education that's of a quality level that will sustain these young people not just into their first job, but their jobs after those first jobs, then I think we're fooling ourselves. So I think we have to be very careful here in terms of the master plan, these three segments, how they were set up, and looking at how they've worked over the past.
But I would say, Joe, is may get me into trouble. I have some questions about the president's proposal. I mean, in principle, it's fine. I mean, I think it, but community college tuition across this country is already very low. I am not sure it is the major impediment. There are a lot of impediments. There's a lot of remedial education that goes on, a lot of kids that don't want to go. So that's one question. I mean, you know, how much of a bounce would they be? And I'd like to take a careful look at the numbers. The other thing is the community, you have to take into account what Janet said. Some people want to take an art history course. Some people are there for technical training. Some people are there to learn to fix computer systems or something. I don't care how you slice it. The two-year graduation rate in this country is abominable. It's frequently in the 10 to 15% range. So before we invest a lot of money, I'd really like to see more accountability in that system and maybe a careful parsing out of the different types of students. But I want to make sure it hits the central problem. I think the sentiment is right, but it's a complicated set of questions. When it works well, you can get dynamite students who messed up in high school, go to a community college, get B's, get admitted to a four-year institution, and do well. I mean, that's at the optimum, but there aren't nearly enough of those kids as far as I'm concerned.
We had a question earlier about out-of-state students and the higher tuition for them. Here's a question from the audience that states as follows. A UC education is highly sought out by international students. Specifically from certain countries. I don't want to just mention one country. It wouldn't sound right. But please pass on the cost of increased fees to them. They can afford it. Any comments?
Well, we do.
I thought so.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, I thought so. So another question for both of you. A modern university's role is multifaceted. What, in your view, should be the primary job of a major university like the University of California? Is it to educate its students, provide research for the military or scientific research for the healthcare sector, including the pharmaceutical industry, for example, or to credential students and prepare them for their careers? How would you rank these in order of importance?
This is a test. Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think your first obligation is to the students. I just want to say that flat out. I'm in favor of the research. I think the medical research is great. I'm glad retractable seat belts were invented at a public university. I like the strawberries from Davis. I like the wine even better. So, I mean, that's all cool to me. So first, your first obligation before you get to anything else is to do right by the students. Second, I don't like a mechanical approach to education. You know, when I was in... at the University of Texas, you know, I'm not sure we offered a course in personal computers. And there was this upstart, Michael Dell, there. I knew this kid would never amount to anything. So, the most important things are developing learning to learn and cognitive skills and learning where to find things. And that, in the end, that will serve industry, that will serve the nonprofits, that will serve the government. So I think that what I worry about is it is not a commodity. It is, yes, you need to know something. I prefer that my surgeon be both analytically smart and have taken anatomy. I don't want one or the other. But having said that, you want an automobile mechanic that can think. You want a banker who can think. And you want a physician or a nurse or whatever that can think. Thinking is something we ought to be teaching these students. And pharmaceutical research is fine. You know, the military research, it depends on what it is, and it can be quite controversial. In some forms, we probably shouldn't do. But that would be my rank ordering.
Well, I think higher ed in the United States today, perhaps many of us, you know, have a paradigm as you go to high school, and then you go to a four-year college, and you get your bachelor's degree. And then maybe if you go on and get your medical degree or law degree or PhD, whatever. But there's kind of a set, model that we have in mind. When in point of fact, there are lots of different models for higher ed in the United States today. And so students have a lot of choice. Some of those choices are very good. I think some of the choices, quite frankly, take a lot of money from the students and don't give them much by way of an a degree or an outcome that they can use. The University of California is a particular model. It is public. It's accessible. 42% of our students are first-generation students. 42%, not the identical same, but 42% are from families that come from less than $80,000 a year income thresholds. So it's public. The doors are open. It's a research university. What does that mean? It means, like, you can take a class from a Nobel laureate. You will undoubtedly have some lab experience, work in teams, be challenged to think critically, and to have analytic skills. And the notion is that you will have some things that will go into a job, but it is for beyond just your first job. It is actually for what will happen thereafter, and all the different types of things young people will do over the course of their lifetimes. And those are the kinds of cognitive skills that you were just talking about. So the public research university has both the accessibility, affordability aspect to it, but also this particular aspect of the research.
This next question could potentially be the really hot button topic of the evening, but that's just...
I think the sitting president should take it then.
And it's perfect for the emeritus.
I have Janet Napolitano's name right on this question here, but in September of last year, Janet, your office, the Office of the President of the University of California, announced the following, and I'm going to quote, "The University of California today announced that it has become a signatory of the United Nations-supported Principles for Responsible Investment, the first American public university to join the leading international network of institutional investors committed to including environmental, social, and governance factors in their investment decision-making." So here's my question. Shouldn't the university only be looking at which investments will yield the highest and safest investment returns to the university under prudent investment standards? Secondly, doesn't being a signatory to this United Nations-supported body of guidelines open up the possibility of a hotbed of political controversy?
Well, the answer to the first question is a false dichotomy. You can be an investor that looks at things like environmental sustainability and provide a healthy rate of return on your investments. We have a fiduciary duty to manage our assets. Nothing we will do or are doing obviates that fiduciary responsibility. But we also think that as a university, a public university, that it is entirely right for us to look at other factors as well. So we see it as a false dichotomy. What was the second question?
Well, the second part
that's
was...
That's the one from Mark, right?
That, right.
Oh, the human rights, the treaty?
Well,
oh,
it could be it could be a hotbed of political activity.
We have a lot of political activity regardless, so we'd have it anyway. No, I don't think so. I think really when you read the UN principles and you look at what this is about, it's saying... As a public institutional investor, and we invest a little over $90 billion through our offices, that we need to be responsible investors, and that we are not just entitled to, but we should be looking at factors in addition to rate of return.
Yeah, I think perhaps I failed in phrasing the question properly, because you answered it the way I asked it, I believe, in terms of the dichotomy. It wasn't exactly what I had in mind. But I do go back to the second part of the question, that I do think, particularly with the United Nations, that it's such a political organization and there could be a lot of issues there that nobody wants, but you may invite, you know, based on certain investment decisions.
Well, again, all I would say is, you know, we're constantly being asked to divest from this, to divest from that. Our view is divestment is kind of a very narrow, limited perhaps symbolic but not substantive way of looking at the world, and that we should be focusing on how we invest. So, for example, investing in clean energy technologies, the kinds of things that will enable us as a university to be carbon neutral by 2025, which is our goal. We think we have a large environmental footprint in California, and we also think we can lead the world in some of these things. And so that is the goal behind the decision to sign on to the principles and look at how we invest, not just at a simple divestment strategy.
So I was at lunch yesterday with a friend of mine, and I told him I was going to be moderating this program tonight. He says, you've got to go on to Google and Google UC Davis and what's going on at UC Davis in terms of hate crimes. So I did, and I was busy, and I didn't find it, and so I wasn't even going to discuss it. But here's several questions about that. So I'm going to ask the question, what do you intend to do to stop hate crimes at UC Davis before it may spread to other campuses? And the second question is, I'm disgusted by the hate crimes at UC Davis. Should the perpetrators be punished and or expelled?
You want to start?
Yeah, I actually worked on that over the weekend. I'm a sort of roving former president without any accountability to anyone. It works very well for me. And
might explain what happened.
But the Davis incident was they had had a contentious few days or maybe longer on divestment, essentially boycotting Israel in various ways, which I'm totally opposed to. In fact, I'm opposed to all these boycotts of that sort. But then the next day or approximately in a Jewish fraternity, there were swastikas drawn on the wall of the fraternity. It was a horrible, horrible incident, perturbed a lot of people. And, what I would simply say is Chancellor Kutahi and Ralph Hextor, her provost, President Napolitano, they were very tough on this. They came out of the box with very tough standards. They're working with a number of Jewish organizations to deal with it. There are even some of the pro-boycott folks on campus who, with some reservations, condemned what had gone on. So it's a horrible thing. I don't think you'll be able to stamp it out forever. We live in a world where racism, anti-Semitism, and so forth do arise, unfortunately. I think they will search for the perpetrators. I don't know exactly what the discipline would be, but they certainly deserve to be disciplined for that. And I just have full confidence in the way it's been handled. I'd like to figure out how to get the conversation more civilized on these campuses. I do not think this is very constructive, what's happening. But you want to respect people's First Amendment rights. No one wants to shut down people. But in many ways, this is not constructive. And it makes Jewish students apprehensive. I've met with Muslim student union leaders. They have their own feelings of isolation in there. I think in many ways the adult community has in some ways failed to deal with these issues in an adequate way.
Everything Mark just said, one of the things we have seen is the growing presence of social impact of social media generated from outside the campus itself that is really acting as an accelerant and an intensifier in some of these quite ugly incidents on our campuses. At a basic level, our students need to feel safe. They should feel that they are in an environment of inclusion. We should be educating students and educating them to the fact that there are different points of view. But when you have a swastika painted on the side of a fraternity, you have to act very quickly and firmly. And the chancellor, her team, we've been on it.
Well, glad to hear that. I hope that answered the questions from the people in the audience that submitted them. So, who would like to take the lead in this question? It's about University of California sports programs and. Maybe it centers more on UC Berkeley, but maybe not as well.
It is perhaps true that there's a growing number of UC academics who are disturbed by the practice of a prestigious university system subsidizing elite athletes at a time of soaring college costs and increasing student tuitions. So just a few years ago, I recall during the tenure of President Mark Udall, for example, the UC Berkeley Athletics Department budget was about $65 million. I don't know if you recall, but I hope that figure is accurate. The school's football coach was Jeff Tedford and was earning about $2.3 million per year. And the university, in fact, had to buy out part of his contract when he left and a new coach was hired. So please feel free to discuss this issue. And perhaps President Napolitano can elaborate about what may happen if a coach's bonus is tied to the academic performance of the athletes. I think that policy was possibly approved by President Napolitano in January, and I want to know, is the policy stuck, or did I read where it might have been modified or abandoned?
You want to talk about costs, and I'll talk about policy?
Oh, sure. I don't know what to say, but I mean, I guess I would start that it's for better or worse, and frequently it's for better. I mean, big time college athletics are with us, and you know, at some schools like Ohio State, I guess, and University of Texas, and places like that, there's very little state money. I don't know exactly what the ratio is at Berkeley. I want to make it clear that anything went wrong with the athletic program at Berkeley is the culpable party is the chancellor, not the president. But it is a problem, and there's an arms race to recruit athletes. But there's a lot of support, and I think it builds a certain sense of community. And if you're going to do this, and look, it's a problem that frequently arises. If you know this, those of you who are in business, if you're going to be in a business, you have to be competitive. And you don't put a $100,000 a year coach against someone making, you know, 10 times as much elsewhere. I'm not saying money's the only thing, but you have to be competitive for the athletes, for the coaches, for the programs, for the equipment, and all the rest of it. And so I think you need to look at the cost carefully. I think you need to put as little on state dollars as possible. But it's a part of university life. If you were in Cambridge, England, it probably wouldn't be that big a deal. But here we are in America, and now the policy issue.
Yeah, so and athletics are paid for out of the student services fee, which the students approve it, and out of there are revenues that come in from television, at least for football and basketball. So I don't want to conflate it with the tuition discussion we had earlier this evening. We had the regents were concerned in part because there was a disturbing story a year ago that the football team at Berkeley had among the lowest graduation rates in the NCAA. Unacceptable. It was to some degree a one-year anomaly. But it was a big canary in a coal mine that Berkeley needed to get on this and do a lot to make sure that if students were coming to Berkeley, they were coming to get a Berkeley education as well as to play football. And Chancellor Dirks and his team have done yeoman's work over the last year to right that ship. The regents were concerned and thought that there should possibly be a regent's policy tying all athletic compensation, contract compensation, in part to academic performance by the teams. And so a draft policy was developed. And it turns out, as in so many things, it's like once you start peeling the onion, it's a little more complicated than one would assume. We have different schools with different teams competing at different levels within the NCAA, among other things. So we have tentatively tabled the draft policy as being too blunt an instrument for what it is we really have throughout the university system. In the meantime, however, the chancellors are on it, and they're on it with the athletic directors. And the understanding is that these are still student athletes. They need to be academically qualified. They need to, if they need extra help, they need that extra help provided. They need to get their degrees, and they need to graduate. And this is part and parcel of being at the University of California as a student athlete. So even absent a policy, we can make sure that these values are upheld.
Mark, anything further to add?
No, I don't want to add very much, but I mean, obviously, big time college athletics is a problem, and I don't know quite what to do. I don't like this arms race in some ways, keeping up with the Joneses, but unfortunately, there's an antitrust act, and that gets in the way occasionally, and it's sometimes difficult to know what to do. I think, in principle, the coaches ought to be responsible for the academic performance of their. I think the president has that just right. I don't know what the percentage should be, and I don't know if, you know, different divisions should have different rules. But in principle, and I didn't get a sense the reason regents were opposed to the principle. It was the complicated details of actually drafting a policy. So I think it's a misreading of the event to say they rose up and said to the president, we don't want to hold them accountable. In fact, we had a number of regents who wanted, in their view, a stricter policy.
I had a conversation with a friend of mine who not only went to the University of Oregon, but went to business school at UC Berkeley, but he's really an Oregon fan through and through, and he said the problem at Berkeley is Title IX. And we had this discussion in the green room. His opinion was that Oregon has far fewer sports that they have to fund, participate in, pay attention to, and so they concentrate on things like football. And that was his
makes no sense.
This doesn't make any
Title
sense.
IX is nationally, even in Oregon, they have to obey the law.
Yeah.
Even in Oregon.
And even with all that, they didn't beat Alabama. So what's the problem
what's
here?
The deal?
Well, now I have some ammunition to go back to him with. That's good. So I'm going to leave that topic quickly.
Yeah.
Several questions about philanthropy, I had one of my own that I had drafted, which
University of California Office of the President. That's how you write the check, and then fill in the blank. Go ahead.
So, what is the role?
Check too.
Pardon me.
I accept checks also.
Made out to the University of California as Office of the President.
Me.
Oh, okay. What is the role and the capacity of philanthropy in education today? Is there enough capacity to make up the shortfalls or part of the shortfalls caused by a decrease in state funding?
You know, we actually, our philanthropy has been going up, and that's a good thing. But it doesn't substitute for state dollars. A lot of the philanthropy, the overwhelming majority of it is directed. It's to build this facility, to endow this chair, to do what have you. It's not money that the president or the chancellor can use to move around through the operational costs of the university. So we need it. We want it. It's a great thing to do. But it doesn't substitute for the operational budget.
I would just entirely agree. When I last looked at it, 98% of the endowments at the university were restricted. They were for scholarships, for good purposes, scholarships, engineering chairs, buildings, or whatever. But you can't just say you have a deficit in the English department and pay that and avoid jail. And the other problem is when you have a $1 billion cut, as the university has, you need, you know, a $10 to $20 billion endowment tomorrow morning to produce the type of income that you've lost. There's a feasibility factor in raising, but it's very helpful, but it's really not going to solve the problem, as the president says.
But the politics, to my experience, at the University of California must be really complex when it comes to what you do with money. I mean, as a board member of the Goldman School of Public Policy, I know at various meetings we do discuss this, and it's the Office of the Chancellor that gets involved and different entities at the university.
at the campus and at the university have to kind of weigh in on philanthropy. Is it too complex, or could it be simplified, or do you feel that it's run fairly and equitably?
Complicated in the sense of how to get the money, or
where the money comes from and for what purpose is, as designated by the donor, and how the donee, or which school, which entity at any particular campus gets the money.
In general, and particularly at a school like Berkeley, you have a development office with professionals who work with potential donors, philanthropy, and the like, in terms of how to structure gifts, to make suggestions on where some funding could be most useful, different ways to address the needs and the ongoing needs of the university. Our campuses each have their own foundations as well, to work with the donor community. So, I don't think it's a matter of complication. It's just a matter of understanding that in the stew that needs to be put together to make sure that we have what we need to educate this next generation. Part of that is philanthropy. Part of it is federal money. Part of it is tuition, and part of it is the state appropriation.
Joe, all I would say is that the movement is really the other way. The large donors today are more likely to be strategic philanthropists. The idea of someone putting their arm around your shoulder and saying, Chancellor, spend it however you please, I trust you. They really have very specific, markers they want to see and outcomes they want to see. So part of the complexity comes from the donors. I do sometimes think we play jailhouse lawyers, but I think it's gotten a lot better that, you know, some English professor thinks he has a better idea about, the American law of trust in estates than has developed over the last 500 years. I think a lot of that is from the donors, although they're, like in any bureaucracy, there could be issues. And I think donors have to be very attentive. That's just my advice, that their money is going exactly where they wanted it to go.
Well, as time is running down in the program, there's two more subjects. I don't know whether we'll have time to cover them all, but let me start with the first one, which is online education. There's so many issues with that. I'm under the impression, perhaps falsely so, that the University of California is adopting certain online education protocols because they're forced into it, that's not the way they want to teach, that they want to teach more with the involvement of students and professors and teaching assistants and sort of the one-on-one as opposed to doing it from your living room or den. Could you please comment on the university's position?
And we've got 2 minutes and 26 seconds left, so in online's a whole, that could be a whole program. But let me just say that we have a lot of work in the online world, a lot of development. That field has changed dramatically from the so-called MOOCs that were the silver bullet of just a few years ago. We have many classes now offered both at the undergraduate level through the Extension Service in the graduate schools. We have entire master's programs that are online, two of which were just ranked number one of their type in the United States. So online is here to stay. A lot of faculty are really engaged in it, and how you do it in the right way. And it tends to be blended, a mix of some things that are online with lecture, small group discussion, lab experience, as opposed to massive online courses, which didn't produce good educational outcomes in the end. So we're in the online world, and I think it's here to stay.
A last comment, or a last question, rather. The president, President Obama, has asked for a universal rating system for colleges and universities. Comment on that, please.
Janet's been rather outspoken on this. I think she should comment on this.
Rather skeptical in the sense of as it was originally posed. If the idea is to put some basic information out there so that students and their families can look at, for example, loan default rates of particular schools, which is one way of seeing whether if you take out a loan to go to the school, are you going to be able to pay it back? That can make a lot of sense. But as I think we've discussed this evening, the realm of higher education in the United States has lots of different ways to do it, lots of different players, and so very difficult to design a cookie-cutter system that really does what it's intended to do.
Well, what a wonderful program with two wonderful people. How lucky those of us who are University of California alums and those of us citizens of the state of California to have people of this high caliber running such a great university. Our thanks to the University of California President Janet Napolitano and UC President Emeritus Mark Udoff for discussing the future of higher education and the University of California system with us tonight. We also thank our audiences here on the radio and online. My name is Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.